Hey everyone, welcome to episode 18 of Whose Crime Is It Anyway? I'll be your host, Lisa Magistrelli, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Shell Morgan.
Hey guys!
Okay, so I didn't realize that iTunes only shows you reviews from your country, which is such a bad feature. But
so we have all these reviews from other countries?
I found like a website that shows us reviews that came from other countries. So this entire time, we had no idea that there were reviews from our listeners outside of Canada. It legit made my day when I read these. It was so exciting.
They're
it was like Christmas.
Bad ones, right?
No, they're good. They're really good. This review was submitted back in February from Maiden in a Trance. It said, "Shell and Lisa, you guys are amazing. Such beautiful souls. Your episodes are filled with information which I love. Your maple syrup heist episode is brilliant. I appreciate that you have created an episode on true crime that isn't about murder. But I also do love murder, true crime, just to be clear."
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, Maiden in a Trance. If you're still tuning in, thank you so, so much.
Thank you. And, you know, we'll bring you some more heist content in the future.
Yeah, that wasn't the only one we got up our sleeves. This week's episode is one that had me really quite disturbed during my research. There's a movie reenactment on this story that I watched, and a 2.5 hour interrogation video that you can also bet I watched in full. So I've always been a movie instead of a book person, so whenever there's a visual, especially a movie, I really get swept up in it, and it pulls a little bit harder at like at the emotions.
Oh yeah.
So
well, it's visual too. You can see
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you just feel it a little bit more. So I have a question for you, Shell.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a mental log of all the underwear you own?
Oh my God. Okay, so I'm probably a bit of an anomaly in this, in that I match my bra and underwear.
Every day?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So mostly every day.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're fully aware.
Yeah, I've had underwear stolen before. My laundry, all my underwear were taken.
Okay.
Because it was a communal washing machine in my old building. And all my very nice Victoria's Secret underwear just happened to vanish from the dryer.
Girl, this is like the freaking Diane Rurendowicz case. And that guy, Ren, got caught in his apartment building.
Right?
Stealing other tenants' underwear. And you didn't say anything?
I know. I got called out on that by a friend.
Really?
That I didn't bring that up. But yes.
Okay, so let's just say you would be really aware if you noticed a pair or two going missing.
Like there's some, you know, you have like your underwear.
Your favorite ones.
You have your favorite ones. And then you have the ones that you leave.
Like until, your period underwear?
Yeah, your period underwear, exactly. You know, you know. Like if that went missing, I'd be like...
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is how this case begins.
In 2007, in the suburbs of Ottawa, Ontario, police became aware of a string of break-ins with very particular similarities. Women's underwear were going missing. The homes of single women were being targeted while they were not home, and police were beginning to worry that this intruder would soon escalate his crimes, putting these women in danger. And they were right. When they finally caught the person responsible, it shocked the country. Because this was a prestigious, well-respected man, and the last person anyone could have suspected. This is the case of Russell Williams. Take it away, girl.
In September 2007, homes of single women were being broken into in the towns of Tweed, Belleville, and Orleans, Ontario. Tweed and Belleville were approximately an hour apart, and Orleans was almost 3 hours north of these towns. The break-ins would occur in the evenings while these women were out, and at first these women wouldn't even notice that someone had been in their homes and would later only find out once this person was caught. But this man was becoming more risky and began to leave an obvious mess amongst their underwear drawer and their beds. The street that was being hit the most was Cozy Cove Lane in Tweed, which led to the neighborhood being on high alert, naming this intruder the Tweed Creeper. So the women that were being targeted ranged from mid-30s to as young as 9 years old.
Ugh, God, it's so gross.
It's gross. But this guy was beginning to torment his victims by leaving them notes. One was in a 12-year-old girl's bedroom. After stealing multiple pairs of her underwear and a photograph of her at the beach, she discovered a note on her laptop that read, "Merci." In June 2008, a 24-year-old woman came home to find her underwear drawer open with a ton of underwear missing, along with one of her sex toys. She called her boyfriend to ask if he had pulled this prank on her, and he denied it, so she started freaking out and asked her boyfriend if she should call the cops. But she decided to go get her neighbor instead. When they both returned, the woman found her laptop open with a note that said, "Go ahead, call the cops. I want to show the judge your really big dildo."
Oh my God. So how did he hear that?
Because when she was on the phone with her boyfriend debating about calling the cops, this guy was still in the house.
Oh my God.
That makes me so sick to my stomach.
Oh my God. I hate this case.
Already.
Oh my God. I hate it already.
Well, okay. So of course, now she reports this to the police and they come get her statement and assess her home, but they couldn't find any evidence. Then in a 15-year-old girl's room, police found semen on the girl's dresser where he had ejaculated. So this pervert wasn't just in and out with the underwear anymore. He's sticking around and he's masturbating in these innocent young girls' bedrooms.
Yeah. Like, this is yikes.
Yeah.
Creepy, cringe, all over.
And apparently with that DNA sample, they weren't able to get enough.
They couldn't run it through the system for some reason.
I don't know why. Some neighbors' homes were hit multiple times. One in particular was hit 9 times. And on the 6th time, police would later learn that this man watched the woman undress, get in her shower, and then he took his clothes off, but then decided to just take her underwear instead and leave.
Wow.
So this poor girl was basically, she dodged a fucking bullet.
Oh my God. This is just such an invasion of privacy.
Yeah.
I just don't even know.
So you can already tell, like, he's starting to get riskier and
he's
riskier.
He's escalating.
Like, it's escalating.
Yeah.
Eventually, this wasn't going to be enough for this guy to get his kicks. After multiple repeat break-ins, he was becoming desensitized and needed to take more risks to satiate his disgusting desires. On September 17th, 2009, 21-year-old Jane Doe was sleeping with her newborn baby in the other room. At approximately 1 a.m., she was woken up to someone smothering her with a pillow and began punching her in the face, telling her not to scream.
Oh my God.
The man blindfolded her and tied her hands behind her back. He then undressed her by cutting her clothes off with a knife and began taking degrading photos and fondled her. The woman was terrified for her life and begged the man not to hurt her baby. He assured her that he was not going to hurt either of them, although he's already punched her in the fucking face.
Yeah, so he's already hurt her.
Sorry, too late.
They try to minimize the situation so that you'll relax more, right? Mm-hmm. They try, no, I won't hurt you.
Yeah, exactly. So at one point, the guy actually showed sympathy and he went and got her a Tylenol and water because she had a headache from the blows to her head.
Oh my
God. He was being nurturing.
Yeah, it's such an act.
But then he would just go right back and start, like, forcing her to take multiple pictures with different pairs of underwear and would tell her how to pose until he was satisfied. And then he eventually left the home after around 2 hours and he took some of her underwear.
She's alive.
She's alive.
Like she's a survivor of this guy.
So at this point, he's just forcing her to take pictures. She's blindfolded, so she doesn't even know what he looks like. All she knows is the sound of his voice.
Okay.
So police were able to obtain DNA from behind Jane Doe's neck. 13 days later, on Cozy Cove Lane in Tweed, Lori Massicotti was sleeping on her couch around midnight when she was struck in the head with a hard object. She began fighting the man and struggled until he gained control over her and said he wouldn't hurt her if she cooperated. He told her that this was a break-in and that there were other guys in the rest of the house and that his role was to keep her under control until they were finished. He blindfolded her, tied her hands behind her back, used a knife to cut off her top, and forced her to pose in her underwear as he fondled her and took degrading photos.
Oh my God.
This lasted approximately 3.5 hours until he told her to count to 200 until she was allowed to remove her blindfold or else he would have to kill her.
3.5 hours.
Can you imagine? Every minute would feel like a fucking eternity. The Ontario Police Department are now on high alert that this man is going to continue until he kills someone. But this person went on a 2-month break until police received their next call on November 23rd, 2009 from Brighton, Ontario, just a few minutes from Belleville. This time, they were too late. 38-year-old Corporal Marie-France Comeau was a flight attendant for the nearby Canadian Air Forces. When she wasn't answering her boyfriend's phone calls, he decided to go to her house to check on her. When he entered her home, he found Marie twisted in her duvet, lifeless on her blood-stained sheets. Her hands were tied and she had duct tape over her mouth and eyes. And her underwear had been stolen, so police immediately knew that this was the same man as the other break-ins. Marie's autopsy report showed that she suffered at least 5 blows to the head, had been sexually assaulted, and the cause of death was suffocation. Police also noticed that there was a load of sheets in the laundry machine that had been run with bleach. There was very little evidence. All they knew was that the voice of this man sounded kind of like a dad based on the accounts from the first 2 women who were assaulted.
Ugh. They're pretty positive at this point that it's the same guy who's been stealing underwear.
Yes.
Yeah. And this would be his first murder, essentially. Yes.
So it's there.
Ugh. And they called it. Like they knew this would happen. So they have no leads at this point.
Nope.
They have no idea who this guy is.
No. There was one person that they suspected, and it was purely based on a voice. So Lori Massicotti went to the police station to try to identify this guy based on hearing his voice. So they did one of those lineups, mm-hmm. and they made them come forward and say the same phrase. Mm-hmm. And she was just using her mm-hmm. audio recognition, which we know
can sometimes be a little bit
iffy. Off.
Yep.
And she identified this guy who was her neighbor down the road.
Oof.
And so he was in hot water.
Okay.
But this is just a suspect at this time.
Yeah.
It would later go on to obviously not be this guy. So okay. Poor fucking guy.
Yeah.
Like the whole community is aware of this now.
Oh, no.
But I mean, fair enough. Like, yes, if it sounds similar and you're in that trauma phase where it's so fresh in your brain, like mm-hmm. sometimes you just think you hear it and it's just a mistake. Another 2 months go by without much activity until January 29th, 2010 in Belleville. 27-year-old school bus driver Jessica Lloyd failed to show up to work, so a family member was contacted and went to her home. Jessica's car was still in the driveway. Her purse and phone were inside, but Jessica wasn't there, and an immediate search was underway. Jessica lived along the side of a main highway that went from Belleville towards Tweed. Her house was situated in this really large field, with a ditch that lined around the back and side of the property. At this time, there was snow on the ground, so luckily, they were able to get a set of tire tracks behind Jessica's house at the edge of the field, as well as two sets of different footprints that tracked to the back entrance of her home.
Okay, so they have a little bit more evidence at this point.
Yes, and it hadn't snowed on top of the track.
So like these were fresh tracks.
Fresh tracks.
This was the guy. This was the tread of his boot and the tire.
Yeah. Two sets of foot tracks. So like a guy and potentially Jessica's.
Okay.
Two different footprints. Police were able to determine that the tire tracks belonged to a specific type of SUV. So on February 4th, they set up a roadblock on Highway 37, leaving Belleville, and began checking tire treads as people passed through. A man that was well known and respected by the community happened to get stopped at the roadblock. He appeared to be in a bit of a rush and said he had to get back to his sick kid, so they checked out his tires and let him pass. But the officers couldn't help but notice that this man's tires were an exact match.
Ooh.
And when they realized that this man didn't have any children and that he had lied, he was immediately put under surveillance.
Why would he lie? So dumb.
Like, could you not have thought of anything else?
Yeah, like, come
on. You're
an
idiot.
Jesus
Christ. People know you. This man was 47-year-old Russell Williams, the colonel and base commander of the Canadian Armed Forces in nearby Trenton, Ontario.
A colonel.
Yeah. Russell was a decorated Air Force pilot who had been in the military for almost 25 years. He had worked his way up the rankings with many, many titles and achievements along the way. At one point, he was flying the VIP plane where he would transport high-ranking government officials and even Queen Elizabeth II.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so this guy was important. This man was so respected within the military as well as the surrounding communities. So if the investigators were wrong on this one, the backlash would not be good.
So they had to be right about this.
Yeah.
This guy was important.
Yeah, this is a huge accusation to make.
Yeah.
Detective Smith sat down with Russell and told him this was not an interrogation and that he was free to leave at any time and had a right to speak with a lawyer. But the colonel declined. He appeared to be very confident and relaxed, so they began the questions. The actual length of this interview, or interrogation really, was about 10 hours, but I could only watch 2.5 of it because that's all that we have available. And honestly, there's not a lot of talking for the most part. Detective Smith spent so much time asking him questions about where he was during certain times. And whenever he'd ask him a straight-up question about Jessica, he just wouldn't talk.
Oh.
So much of the video consisted of pauses that literally lasted minutes. He agreed to submit his DNA and his boot prints, no problem. But that was because he didn't think the investigators had any of that.
Oh, so he didn't know that they had those
footprints
and the tire treads from
and
the snow.
And his DNA from the back of Jane Doe's neck.
Right. Oh, he's cocky at this point.
Oh, so cocky.
Like, he's going in there thinking that, you know, his ranking.
Oh, yeah.
His prestige, everything. Like, he's getting out of there a free man.
Exactly. So when Detective Smith told him that they had imprints of tire tracks outside Jessica's home that matched his Pathfinder SUV, Russell seemed so surprised. But still, at this point, he's not admitting it. Then the detective tells him that they have a shoe print, and it matched the exact boot that he had worn to the interview.
Oh my God, he wore the same
boot. He wore them.
Boot!
Like, he literally thinks he's invincible.
Oh,
but still, he's not talking. Then Detective Smith tells him that they have a search warrant for all three of his homes and that the police were searching them at that exact moment. And they also said that his wife had now been informed of what was going on. And so that's when things started to change. It had now been 5 hours of trying to get Russell to break, Detective Smith's tone began to change in a way that was backing Russell into a corner by saying, "They're gonna find everything in this house, so he needs to start telling the truth." Detective Smith said, "If you don't give me your story, we're gonna have a different one, which is, you're a cold-blooded psychopath. Is that what you want, or do you want to control the situation?"
Ooh, playing into control.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So Russell begins speaking and says first that he was concerned about what his wife must be going through and the impact this would have on the military. It became clear that he was considering actually confessing, but was genuinely concerned for his wife.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah.
This was like his... What is with this, though? Like, these killers, these murderers, and then they actually love their
wives. Yeah, how can you be both? How can you have these two separate lives and you still have emotion?
Mm-hmm. Sociopath.
Mm-hmm. Detective Smith pushes forward and says the best way to minimize the impact on his wife is to tell the truth. So he asks him again, "Where is Jessica?" And after a long pause, Russell says, "Got a map?"
Oh my God.
So here are some clips from this interrogation.
"The problem is, Russell, is every time I walk out of this room, there's another issue that comes up, okay? And it's not issues that point away from you. It's issues that point at you, okay? And I want you to see what I mean, all right? This is the footwear impression of the person who approached the rear of Jessica Lloyd's house on the evening of the 28th and 29th of January, okay? This is a photocopy of the boot that you took off your foot just a little while ago, okay? Now, I'm not an expert in footwear impressions, so I rely on the experts. Footwear impressions are very much like fingerprint comparisons, okay? You take a look at this print, and again, this is one print. This person walked through, there's several different prints to compare. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna get features off of one print to compare, features off another print to compare.
Yep.
These are identical. Your vehicle drove up the side of Jessica Lloyd's house. Your boots walked to the back of Jessica Lloyd's house on the evening of the 28th and 29th of January. Right now, there's a search warrant being executed at your residence in Ottawa. So your wife now knows what's going on. There's a search warrant being executed at your residence in Tweed, and your vehicle's been seized, okay? You and I both know they're going to find evidence that links you to these situations. Okay. You and I both know that the unknown offender, male, on Marie France Como's body, is going to be matched to you, quite possibly before the evening's over.
So you talk about perception. My only two immediate concerns from a perception perspective are what my wife must be going through right now.
Yeah.
And the impact this is going to have on the Canadian forces.
Where do we go?
I'm struggling with how upset my wife is right now. I'm concerned that they're tearing apart my wife's brand new house.
So am I. But if nobody tells them what's there and what's not, they don't have any choice. Computers will be brought to Microsoft in California. They'll be picked apart. You can't erase things from computers. Do we talk?
I want to minimize the impact on my wife.
So do I.
So how do we do that?
Well, we start by telling the truth.
Okay.
Okay. So where is she?
Get him out.
I mean, I think it was a good interrogation. I mean,
he has been applauded for the job that this detective did interrogating him for 10 fucking hours.
Yeah.
And getting him to confess.
Totally. And he pushed on the right buttons, mm-hmm. right? Like, he went for that colonel control, like, that's his sort of mindset. And then slowly but surely, he started letting out a few more things.
Mm-hmm.
Realized the wife was a sore spot.
Yes.
Pressed into that, like... pressed into the control factor.
Yeah. Like, you don't want them to tear apart your house? Well, fucking tell us where everything is so we don't tear it apart then.
Yeah.
Let's make this easier for her.
Mm-hmm.
So Russell does go on to confess to the murders of Corporal Marie-France Comeau, Jessica Lloyd, and the two attacks in Tweed, and to the break-ins of over 45 houses.
45.
45 fucking houses.
In these communities.
Yes. He fessed up to everything in detail, including what he did to his victims and where he put Jessica's body.
Ugh.
Within days, Russell had taken them to a forested area off a rural road where they located her body. Russell said his fetish for women's underwear began in his 20s, but he never acted on it until his early 40s. He admitted that he would break into his neighbors' homes multiple times without them even noticing. He admitted to over 80 break-ins. So because there was 45 houses and they had multiple hits, it added up to 80 total break-ins.
80 times this guy broke into homes and yeah. wasn't caught.
Get this. Approximately 60 out of those 80 break-ins didn't even know that they were victims until he told the police which houses he hit. So legit, there were only around 18 police reports of break-ins. And then he tells them that, oh, it was actually 80 over the span of 2 years.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
So these people just had no idea.
He was good. He was really good. His next door neighbor, who happened to be a friend of his with a family, was his first target. They were friends.
Oh my God.
Like, they would have family dinners. They would go fishing together and stuff. So he broke into their home 3 times, stealing their teenage daughter's underwear. And this wasn't all. When police searched his house, Russell directed them where they could find his hidden hard drives with photographic evidence of his crimes. When they did their search, they found 1,400 items of stolen underwear and bras, all organized, all cataloged in a computer file like an inventory.
Oh my God. 1,400.
1,400.
Oh my God.
Just try and picture that in front of your face. Is that like an entire Victoria's Secret store?
Yeah.
Actually.
It's like a warehouse.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And when they opened those hard drives, they discovered that Russell was obsessed. He had a very organized routine of taking pictures first of the bedroom, then of a pile of underwear. Then he would lay them out and take pictures of them individually. Then they saw the selfies. Russell was putting on these women's underwear and posing for pictures.
And wait. What?
Yeah.
What?
So there's pictures of him wearing these women's and young girls' underwear. And he was posing for pictures.
The selfies.
Yes. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with cross-dressing, wearing women's underwear. What you do in the privacy of your own home is whatever to me. But these are stolen.
Stolen children's underwear.
Yes. And you're masturbating in their rooms. Yeah, he's getting off on
it. Like, yeah. This is what's disgusting about it. It's not just the wearing underwear. It's like, they're stolen children's underwear that he is now getting off
associating
on.
Associating that they're from little girls.
Yeah, he's a pedophile.
Yes.
And that is illegal, everyone. So there we go.
So one of his common poses was looking over his shoulder at the camera, kind of like on the red carpet or something.
No.
And then there were photos of him laying naked in their beds masturbating. Russell claimed that he would target the homes of attractive women in their late teens to early 30s, but 18 of these break-ins were girls under 18 and as young as 9. There would often be stuffed animals in the background of the pictures, and his pictures were pretty graphic. One showed him holding a 15-year-old's makeup brush against his penis.
Oh.
And then... Ugh. Another one was a photo of a dildo strapped against his own penis.
Th- This guy is sick.
Just disgusting.
And he also sounds super OCD.
Oh, very OCD.
Like, he's obsessive compulsive about his fetish.
Yes. Super organized, having it all in a catalog, like, yeah, inventory.
And he has to take the photos in the same way, in, yes, the same fashion.
Yes. Like, if you look at the pictures of him posing in the underwear, he's standing in the exact same spot with the exact same pose. It's almost like he put markers on the ground so he could stand on them. And it was just, it was so,
yeah,
specific.
Yeah. And that also lends to probably his background in military. You're, mm-hmm, so regimented.
What a perfect type of personality, yeah, for the military.
Oh, man.
Russell shared what happened on the night of Marie's death. This was the corporal flight attendant from the Canadian Forces in Trenton, the same base as Russell's. So she was actually under his command and had even flown with him once. Russell said he broke into her basement through an unlocked window at around 11 p.m. because he had access to her schedule and knew that she would be out. He waited in her basement until she came home and was planning to wait until she went to bed, but her cat came down into the basement and wouldn't stop meowing at him, hiding in the shadowy corner.
Oh my God.
Marie came downstairs looking for her cat and noticed that she was staring at something. So as she approached the cat, she saw Russell and started screaming. Russell lunged at her as she fought back, but he struck her in the head with a large flashlight and knocked her unconscious. He then tied her up and carried her upstairs to her bedroom, where he continually raped and beat her, all while filming this on video.
Oh my God.
Marie was seen fighting back and even tried to make a run for it when he left the room at one point, but he caught her. She pled for her life throughout the attack, but Russell was ruthless all throughout. After several hours of torture, he put duct tape over her nose and mouth and filmed as he sat back and watched her suffocate. He then put the sheets in the wash and left and went to work the next day like it was nothing. Then, 18 days later, he has the fucking audacity to send a condolences letter to her fucking dad.
Oh, God.
So he's, like, inserting himself.
Of course, because they do that. Yeah. They can't, like, help it.
Mm-hmm. So 2 months after this, he attacks Jessica Lloyd. He states he had never met her, and the way he chose her was because he saw her running on her treadmill at home as he was driving by, which I find really weird. How do you even get a good look at somebody if you're just passing by on a highway and see someone on a treadmill?
He was searching.
Totally.
I feel like he was totally searching for someone.
Like, if you're gonna admit to shit, just fucking say it.
Yeah.
He broke into her home a few days before her attack to suss out the house and see if she lived with anyone. So when he came back on the night of January 29th, he parked his SUV beside her house in the far edge of the field. And what investigators find out is absolutely gutting. After Russell had gotten out of his SUV, he approached Jessica's house from the back. And when he was in the backyard, he noticed a car in the driveway, and someone was at the front door. He said he wasn't sure if it was Jessica, but then he saw them walk away, so then he entered her home. That person knocking on her door was a local police officer doing her rounds of the neighborhood due to the high risk of all the recent attacks.
Oh no.
That police officer was within meters from Jessica's killer.
Holy shit.
Once Russell entered Jessica's house, he waited for her to come home and fall asleep. He woke her up the same way as his other victims, by striking her multiple times in the head with a flashlight. He tied and blindfolded Jessica, forcing her to pose in her underwear, and would repeatedly rape her. He promised Jessica that if she cooperated, then he wouldn't kill her. So she did everything he asked. And this was all on video.
Oh my God, it's so sick.
After a few hours, he then kidnapped Jessica from her home and took her to his cottage in Tweed. He let her shower, but went in with her because her hands were still tied. He said he let her nap afterwards, but laid with her with a rope tied around her hands and his waist so that there wasn't any give. She then woke up and had a seizure. Oh, no.
It was brought on by stress. She warned him that this has happened to her in the past, and she could feel it coming on, and she needed to get to a hospital or she's going to die. He says he helped her through the seizure, ensuring that she didn't bite her tongue. But even after that tiny shred of humanity, it didn't last. He then went on to take more photos of her and raped her again. This literally went on all day and into the night, until it was finally over. He let Jessica eat some fruit, and then they got up and headed for the door. Jessica thought he was taking her home. That's when Russell strikes her in the back of the head with the flashlight, cracking her skull. He then videotaped himself strangling Jessica with a rope, killing her on the floor.
Oh my God.
She thought she was free. Mm. It's so fucking awful.
It's so awful.
And you're videotaping it.
He's so sick and twisted.
He's so sick. He's so deep into it now. He's just not even in reality.
Well, it's like you said in the beginning, it's like these small acts, breaking in, taking the underwear, then leaving notes. It starts to become not enough.
Yeah.
He's desensitized. Yeah, he's desensitized. He has to escalate. He needs more. It's not feeling the same. Mm-hmm. Okay, what can I do next? Next, next.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's already taking photos of everything. So taking videos is probably just a natural next progression. Oh, oh my God. It's such a hard case.
I know. I had nightmares. I had full-blown nightmares doing this case. Russell put Jessica's body in the garage and he left the next morning on an assignment for 3 days. When he came back, he took Jessica's body and left her in a forested area off a nearby road. Shortly after his arrest, Russell attempted suicide in his cell by shoving the cardboard from a toilet paper roll down his throat.
Oh.
But the guards were able to intervene and he was placed on suicide watch. Russell was charged with 88 offenses, which include 2 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of sexual assault, 2 counts of forcible confinement, and 82 counts of break and enters. And Russell said he would plead guilty to all of these charges, no problem, as long as they didn't include the child pornography found on his hard drives.
Oh my God. Well, you know, like if child rapists or child molesters, when they go to jail, they don't do well in jail.
No. So they agreed. He also said that by him pleading guilty and bypassing a trial, it would save the taxpayers money for an expensive trial. So they agreed, and this asshole got off on child pornography charges. But this didn't mean he didn't still go to court, where hundreds of pieces of evidence were presented to everyone, including hundreds of images of Russell wearing women's underwear and images of him laying in their beds masturbating. Shameful.
He's the worst.
He would sit in court with his head down, appearing ashamed throughout the entire thing. Russell Williams was sentenced to 2 first-degree murder charges, which in Canada is just 25 years total, not 50. And that was without the possibility of parole for 25 years. This was how people were served their sentences until December 2011. Provisions were made to the Criminal Code in Canada, where a trial judge can decide whether or not the charges can be concurrent or served additionally. So Russell just barely snuck in before that was put into place. Mm. He could have possibly been serving 50 years.
Ugh.
As you would expect, the survivors and families of the victims were going to press charges. And what Russell and his wife Mary pulled was some shady shit.
And his wife?
Yeah.
Oh,
6 weeks after his arrest, Mary bought out Russell on one of their homes for $62,000, so everything was in her possession. The house was valued at $700,000. They claim that they were just trying to set Mary up financially because he was no longer there for her, but Mary was quite successful in her own career anyways, as one of the senior executives at the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada. So she was going to be just fine. But the victims saw this as a way to shield Russell's assets so they couldn't come after his properties.
Completely.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get, any payment from it.
Well, they still went after them.
Good.
4 years after the conviction, Jane Doe and the family of Jessica Lloyd all reached an out-of-court financial settlement from Russell Williams. Jane Doe's original claim sought $2.45 million, and Jessica's family sought $4 million. But the lawsuits weren't over. Lori Massicotti filed two lawsuits, one against the OPP, stating that police failed to warn her neighborhood about a potential predator, and one against Russell Williams, for a total of $7 million, which she eventually settled in 2016. Apparently, Mary, his wife, filed for divorce in 2010, but she wanted the divorce files to be private from the public, but it was denied. So, as of now, they're technically still married.
It was denied? Like, he didn't sign the divorce papers?
No, they weren't allowing the documents to be sealed so that no one could see anything to do with their divorce.
Got it.
They wouldn't allow it. So she's like, all right, well, then I'm not going to continue with the fucking divorce, I guess. Can you imagine if you found out that you were married to a monster and your whole life is on display now? Like, it is humiliating.
How did she not know?
That's another thing.
I'm sorry. I have to say it. I know that maybe that's controversial to say, but did she not have an inkling when he was away or spending time at
out
the
in
other
the night?
Homes out at night? Like,
so he has a arthritic condition and he would often go out for walks at night because it made it feel better. So even his neighbors would say, oh yeah, like I see him out walking all the time. So this was his kind of excuse why he would be out. Oh, okay. I'm just walking because of my arthritis. But you're not the only person to say that Mary might have known something. Lori Massicotti went on to say, like, she's accusing Mary of knowing that he was a predator and didn't say anything to the police. But Mary's attorney is saying that this is absolute garbage. Like, there is no way that she knew. You cannot say that about her. Like, of course she didn't know. It's unthinkable that she could know and not say anything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that, though.
Did she ever walk in and catch him trying on her underwear? Like, that is something that I think if you're married, that might have happened.
Right?
Maybe she's like, what the fuck are you doing right now?
Or maybe he was too embarrassed to tell her that this is what he was into. So maybe this is why he resorted to going to these extremes to get it.
Because it was suppressed.
Maybe.
It's not her fault by any
definitely
means.
Definitely not.
But I'm just saying, oh, it kind of, and the whole transferring of the money makes me feel a little icky.
Totally.
And then wanting the divorce to be sealed.
Totally. Like what don't you want people
to
know?
It just all seems a little bit odd.
You know what really pisses me off? This is just the icing on the cake for me. Russell Williams is still entitled to his pension from the Canadian Air Force.
So he gets paid while he's in jail?
Yeah, it's unfucking touchable. He is currently receiving $60,000 a year.
Oh, just sitting in jail.
Yeah, so I'm sure he's getting all the pretty things that he wants in prison with ease. Like, he's living quite nicely in maximum security prison right now.
Oh, no.
He gets everything he wants, probably. And one more thing to put things into perspective as to how respected Russell Williams was.
Mm-hmm.
On December 11th, 2009, he carried the Olympic torch through his town as it made its way across the country for the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. When he carried that torch, he had already committed the two attacks on Jane Doe and Lori Massicotti.
Oh my God.
And you can Google a picture of him holding on to that fucking torch and you look at this guy and be like, oh my God. You've already done these two attacks. No one knew.
Just living life.
Yeah. Russell Williams' uniform was incinerated by the military.
Whoa.
At the Canadian Forces in Trenton, where they revoked all of his accomplishments, stating that Russell was a complete betrayal and will never be forgiven.
Oh, wow.
From flying military jets and VIP dignitaries to living in a cell the size of a closet, 57-year-old Russell Williams is serving his two life sentences at maximum security in Kingston Penitentiary in Ontario. Jane Doe, Lori Massicotti, Marie-France Como, and Jessica Lloyd all got the justice they deserved, but they never did anything to deserve to be victims of this heinous, sadistic murderer. So we're no longer wondering, whose crime is it anyway?
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Whose Crime Is It Anyway? We will be back next week with a brand new case. Until then, follow us on Instagram at Whose Crime Podcast and find us on Twitter at Whose Crime Pod. And if you like what you're hearing from us, leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts.
And if you're going to give us one star, just leave a review so that we know what we're doing wrong and we can do better for you.
Hey, feedback is always welcome.
Exactly. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Doodles.
Do you think that he stole Queen Elizabeth's underwear?
We would probably be fucking put in jail if we put that on the podcast. How dare you?
How speak dare of the you queen?
Off with your head and her panties.